listener production.
The creators of this podcast would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which it is recorded. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are the first storytellers of this land. We pay respect to their elders, past, present, and emerging, as well as any Indigenous people who may be listening today.
Everyone relax. This is Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and this is how the show starts. Well, actually, you know what? Just before I get into how the show starts, I'm going to do a little... Sometimes I change my mind halfway through the introduction, and I'm going to do a little bit more of an introduction because this is one of those episodes, and if you're a regular listener to this show over the decade or so that we have been doing it, you will know that I have various favourite types of episodes, but one of my real favourites is that if there's someone that I have become a fan of recently, have discovered recently their comedy and have grown to very much enjoy it and then have spotted an opportunity to not only see them online but to know that they are going to come to Australia and visit and I'll get the opportunity to see them live. And, of course, I've used that as an opportunity to then get them on the show and talk to them and get to know them. So it's one of those episodes where I don't really know the guests other than their work and I'm very excited about that. So I'll ask the standard question I ask at the start after all that long ramble. I'm so sorry. Who are you is the question. Who are you?
My name is Olga Koch, and I'm a stand-up comedian.
Yeah, I mean, I really fucked around a lot there, Olga. Like, and you really got straight to the point, and I appreciate that. You've got us back on track. It might have something to do with the fact that it is nighttime in Australia as I record this, and you are fresh and
chipper in the morning. I'm 2 coffees in. I'm ready to go.
Tell me, like, so where are you at the moment? Do I find you in the UK? Is that where you are?
Yes, I'm in London. I'm at my flat in London where I live and where I'm based.
And what is an average day for you as a comedian? Like, are you normally an early riser? Have you got up specifically because you had something like this to do today? Or are you normally somebody who's up and about into the day?
Oh, I try to wake up early-ish every day because I feel like many people, I'm fueled by guilt. And so I am still for even 1 second. There's a voice in my head that says that I should be. There's something I could be doing.
Now, fueled by guilt is an interesting thing to bring up immediately. Is that religious? Because normally when somebody says fueled by guilt, it normally had some historical background. Like most of my friends that I would talk to who I would identify as being fueled by guilt, so many of them had a Catholic upbringing. Did you have a religious upbringing somewhere where the guilt came from, or where does it come from?
That is a very, very good question. I think it comes from, so my parents were born and raised in the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. where sort of the work ethic and the labor were king. So I would say it was a religion of labor. And I think working hard is something that was instilled in them from a very young age. And then it was instilled in me. And I wouldn't say in a positive sense, it would be like, if you're not doing anything, you're a bad person. And if you're doing everything, that's normal.
Okay, so that's interesting to me though, because of course, often when people relocate, you know, from an origin country, there can be two things, right? They double down on, you know, what was all good about the place that they've left, you know, or they, you know, completely reject that, embrace the place that they have gone to. So were your family more in the camp of, you know, we're teaching all these, you know, things that are our tradition and our customs and our history, or were they more in the camp, if you had to do a percentage of, we're in a new place now, let's embrace, you know, this new place and its ways?
So my parents, I was born and raised in Russia, uh-huh. and I only ever lived abroad without my parents. So whatever
so
they instilled in me, they instilled
so
in me in
Russia.
So they're
still there.
They're in Germany now, but they moved to Germany and I moved to the UK. It's a very complicated, convoluted system.
Yeah, look, I mean, I have clearly not done enough research.
Oh, God,
to work
no,
it out.
This is.
But so when did you move to the UK?
So I moved to the UK when I was 14 years old.
Uh huh. And so how do you move to the UK when you're 14 years old if it isn't?
You get sent to boarding school, Will.
Oh, okay. And so what's the purpose of you being sent to boarding school? Like, what has life looked like for you in Russia up until that point? And what is the purpose of you being sent abroad at 14 years old to go to boarding school?
I mean, the funny answer is to make me gay. But it only...
You couldn't do that at home? There was...
Not in Russia. No, they...
No gay people in Russia. I remember what Putin said. Not one.
No, but in 4 years, it only ever managed to make me bisexual. And for that, I'm grateful. The reality is, essentially, I've done a few sort of shows about it. I did a radio show about it. I did a stage show about it. But my dad got into some trouble with the government, and around the early to mid 2000s, we collectively realized that we had to go. At least my parents did. And so they moved to Germany, and I didn't speak German. So I got sent to, I spoke English. So I got sent to a boarding school in the UK.
Okay. I mean, so much material to work with in a comedic sense, right? Like, it's one of those things that when you started doing comedy, we'll jump all over the place until we find our feet, because there's just so many things that interconnect with each other. But when you start doing comedy and you have such a, I mean, we've barely started this conversation and there's so much richness to your story already and intrigues and rabbit holes. What was your attitude towards how much of your autobiography you were going to mine in regard to what you were going to put on stage? And as you said, there was obviously some danger involved that it meant that your parents had had to leave and that you had also had to leave. I mean, I imagine then that dealing with some of those topics, or, you know, talking about why and wherefore and what might have caused those things, also still comes with some sort of referred danger. So just when you first started doing comedy, did you have a sense of how autobiographically, you know, you were going to mine your life? And has it been more or less than you imagined so far?
So what's interesting, and I'm aware of how cynical this might come off, is when at least in the UK, sort of you start doing comedy, you have your, I don't know, 5-10 minute set, where I'd say in the beginning leaned in quite heavily into being a Russian stereotype. It was like mail order bride vibes, and it was quite easy material for a 5 minute set, right? And then because I was in the UK, there was this like cult of the fringe, this idea that you have to come up with an hour long show to take to the fringe. And I think for me, the gap between my writing and comedic ability, I found that I could bridge that gap with being interesting, if that makes sense. Yeah. So when my writing wasn't there, I was like, oh, I can bring value by telling this fascinating story. And I think even if I look back at my early reviews, they were like, the story's great, but there are no jokes. And so I think when I was, it was almost like a sort of crutch, I guess, to me. To offer that to the audience, because I was like, well, this is undeniably fascinating and I have nothing to do with it. And then with time, I kept making it funnier, funnier, funnier. And then I realized that I didn't necessarily need that crutch anymore and I could just be funny, or at least I think so.
Okay, so I'm super interested in, because I came into, where I've come into being aware of you, you know, like, I mean, I love stand-up comedy, but I am not as online as, you know.
Also, I don't assume anyone knows who I am. So please, Will, don't.
No. But, I mean, this is, sorry, this, by the way, Olga, this is absolutely the style of the show. Having a nervous breakdown constantly throughout it will be part of what you'll have to put up with for the next hour and a half. So no, I mean, I'm, because for, it's interesting to me, like, you know, when I first started doing comedy, there was no internet and there was no, you know, like the idea of somebody passing around, you know, like someone might pass around a Bill Hicks, you know, recording or like video or something, you know, that somebody had dubbed off something like that. But there was no sort of sense of, oh, I can go on Instagram and I can discover new comedians. And there really wasn't that sense of that there is now, where there are thousands and thousands of people who consider themselves to be comedians working all over the world. And they're just working in this
world. That was such a shady way to phrase it. I love it.
I mean, I wasn't even really intending it to be shady, because I'm not the gatekeeper of what is, like, you know, I'm just saying it's happening in a place that I'm not seeing. The place that I would traditionally discover people at a festival, or, you know, in that long form way, is not the modern way of comedy. So I discovered your comedy through short form, though. Like, it was, for whatever reason, what you were doing cut through a whole lot of noise. And, you know, your clips seemed to really work in that format. And the majority of the stuff that I was seeing was very sex forward, sex positive, you know, stuff. That, I mean, all this, you know, I guess that's the reason I asked the question and why these questions are often so long at the start of this chat is just to contextualize where I'm coming from. But it's surprising to me because in the way that I discovered you, I didn't go with you on the journey from open mics to Edinburgh Fringe to, I just found this stuff of you from, you know, the Apollo and other places doing like, you know, modern, like, you know, like you said, bisexual sex jokes, like things about dating, things, but like good jokes, like good takes, very funny jokes, like great attitudes, like, you know, just really cut through what a lot of other people were doing in that space. So it's just fascinating to me. Like, do you have short form versions of these longer autobiographical things as well? Like, are there clips in the same way as your modern clips work that are, you know, that rely on this autobiographical stuff, I guess is the question I'm trying to ask.
It's funny to me. So it's funny to me that like I will upload all of it. There will be stuff that is not sexual at all, but that will be the stuff that cuts through. So it will be, they like my clips about dating will obviously get significantly more views than my clips about, I don't know, immigration to the United Kingdom and the bureaucratic process of it. And I understand that, well, they have larger mass appeal. And I also, it's really interesting because whenever I talk about this, and I talk about this a lot, is I'm very hesitant to, how do I phrase this? Almost like badmouth or condescend to my material about sex and dating or anyone's material about sex and dating. Because a lot of time I'll get comments from men who are like, can women joke about anything other than sex? And my immediate response, knee-jerk reaction is like, well, I have other jokes. I have jokes about the Russian privatization. I can show them to you. But then I need to stop myself and be like, that's me creating a hierarchy in my head of thinking some jokes are better than others or like morally superior. And I don't think that's true. And I don't want to support that. So I'm as proud of my sex gags as I am of any other gag.
I agree, by the way. Like, I mean, we're both Swiss that you should be proud of the
jokes.
Sorry,
we're both having nervous breakdowns, Will.
No, this is good. I'm into this now. I feel like we've found our vibe. It's okay. We just needed to connect with the nighttime, daytime energy. And I think we've found a happy medium in between now. We're good. But no, I agree. I mean, great jokes, good bits. And, you know, but that idea of it, the minute that you dip your toe into that debate that, yes, like you said, anything else is more worthy, then I think that's the trap, isn't it? Like when you first start out, you talked about that idea of going, I had this worthy material, like as in of import, you know, interesting stories to tell. It just wasn't particularly worthy comedically yet. You hadn't found that way to unlock it. Whereas in this other material I've seen, you know, part of the reason that it's obviously done so well and cuts through is that people find it relatable and funny and they pass it on. Like if I'm seeing it, that's how it has happened. You know, I then, once I had seen it, you know, did some work of my own to go and find some other stuff. But I'm just fascinated because I'm so interested in the story of your background now that I'm, you know, aware of it. In the 10 minutes I've known, it's really blown my mind a little bit. And so I was just interested.
We can talk
in
about it. You can ask me whatever.
Yeah, I mean, well, I would love to. Okay, so like, I mean, without, you know, talking about anything that you don't want to talk about. Let's just start with the question I originally posed, which was how dangerous was anything that you were talking about? Was there anything that was genuinely off limits in terms of I cannot tell this part of like my story?
That's a very interesting question. I guess all of everything that I think about this is very, it's conjecture. It's theoretical. I don't know anything for sure. So everything that I told in the shows about how my family escaped Russia was either factual or like for the purposes of the story, a bit exaggerated or like some characters are conflated. All of that thing was like, I don't think any of it was like libelous or dangerous. I don't think. There have been moments though where I was saying stuff on TV. Like, I think I remember, there was a time where on a show called Late Night MASH, I told Vladimir Putin to suck my dick. Sorry. So not suck his own dick. He could try. And then that's when I did feel like maybe if anyone on the border would come across that, it wouldn't be particularly safe for me to go back.
Yeah. And do you go back?
I used to work for like 6 years while I was doing stand-up. I had a day job, and that day job had me going back to Russia quite often. But since I've quit, I have not been back. And I don't think I'd feel safe now after telling Vladimir Putin to suck my dick.
No, I don't think so either. I mean, again,
thank you, Will.
Feels like you're making good, positive choices for yourself. Can't say anything anymore. Bloody comedy. Can't say anything anymore. I mean, tell Vladimir Putin to suck his own dick on television, and now I'm for my life going back to Russia. But, you know, you can't say anything anymore. Remember that.
But, Will, have you considered how funny it would be to have to be stopped at the border and to be played a clip and then to have to explain it to, like, the KGB? That would be so funny. Like,
I don't know if it, like, I mean, maybe a funny story to tell later, a funny incident to speculate upon right now, but something that would actually be funny to go through. I mean, again, maybe they're getting a bad reputation in the West, but the KGB don't, like, not renowned internationally for their sense of humor. Okay, so you come to England. You're 14 years old. You go to boarding school. Okay. So, what's life in Russia been? Give us a little picture of what your life in Russia looks like before 14 and before you end up going to boarding school.
I guess. Once you don't know otherwise, you don't really know what's odd about it. But I think I had culturally quite a standard Russian upbringing. I guess socioeconomically, I was extremely privileged. And I think there was like a notoriety around my dad that I was always aware of, because he used to be a politician, and then he was like a game show host, and then he was like enemy of state. So there was always a sort of feel.
I mean, it's a great character arc, isn't it? Like, politician, game show host, enemy of state.
The big three. And so...
Well, it's just a great business card. It's a pity business cards aren't a thing anymore, because, like, just handing someone, you just go, former politician, game show host, enemy of state.
You know, he was trying to find himself. And there was always a sort of air of notoriety around him. Uh-huh. I think because my last name is not particularly Russian, it's actually like an ethnically German last name, it was always like very like, oh, that... you're that Koch. And so when I moved, I guess, the big difference that nobody had any idea who the fuck my dad was. And I've lived that way for most of my life now.
And so when you're a 14-year-old girl and you're being sent to, you know, the UK to go to boarding school, what's your state of mind at the time? Are you full of anticipation for this? Are you excited about, you know, this new life that you're about to be living? Are you fearful of what's about to happen? Like, what sort of state of mind are you in about it all? I mean, you're leaving your parents, like they're, you know, going to live somewhere else. I mean, there's a lot going on.
I mean, I was desperate to stay in Russia. I loved living in Russia. We're there. No one has ever asked me this, Will. Not once.
Okay. Good, there we go. I told Olga before we started, I'm like, we've got to get to at least one thing that no one's ever asked you. I feel like we've danced around a lot of things that people have asked you before already. So let's get into one that no one has. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't be even exaggerating if I said, like, I think I was a patriot up until I was in my late teens, and I was really, really excited to live in Russia and stay in Russia. And so moving was kind of a tragedy. Obviously, like, leaving your friends behind when you were 14 and starting over was really, really scary.
And so boarding school, what does that look like? Because I didn't go to boarding school, but it's like, is it an all-girls school?
No, it was not an all-girls school. What was fascinating about it, it was an American school. That's the reason I sound American. And so American schools are usually like for American diplomats or American military personnel. The joke I make this is because they can't bear the thought of their children taking even one geography class. But they're all over the world. But the sort of paradox of having an American school in an already English-speaking country. It's so bizarre. And so I was put into this bubble that was a completely unrealistic an unrealistic representation of anything. So it wasn't really American. It wasn't really the UK. I was talking to a friend of mine who we both went to school, and I was like, at some point, we had no idea who was the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. That's how tuned out we were. Like, I remember telling someone that I lived
like, today you are truly American. Well done.
I remember I lived in the United Kingdom from the years 2006 to 2010, and I had not heard one Arctic Monkeys song. That's crazy.
I mean, that is so funny to be raised in the place, but without. And also the other great thing is, like, we're going to raise you here. We're going to teach you the language, but here's what we're not going to teach you. Any of the appropriate cultural references, where you're going to miss all of those. And occasionally we're just going to spell a word or pronounce a word differently to the place where you live. Yeah,
exactly.
You'll be sailing along in a sentence thinking you are speaking perfectly normally, and then we're just going to have told you the wrong way to say something. Sorry, you won't know which word it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. Like, at some point, you know, when you're in the middle of, like, suburban England, learning every American president, you're just like, what is this? And who is this for?
And so, yeah, so the people that the other kids who are there, like, where are they? Are they mostly American kids, or are they just people who are learning in that environment?
So majority was American, because they had, like, they were parents, like, there were a lot of American companies around. So some parents got sent out to work in the UK for an American company. A lot of people would only stay for like a year or two. Yeah. And then the other people wanted to go to American universities, which is why my parents sent me there, because they want me to go to university in America.
And did you end up going to university in America?
I did end up going to university in America.
Okay. Where did you go to university in America?
I went to New York University.
New York University. Now, are you talking about New York City, the Big Apple, the city that never sleeps?
Oh, that's the one.
The town's so nice, they named it twice. Yeah, that
ding,
New
ding,
York?
Ding. Yeah.
No. I know heaps of stuff about places. So you go to New York. I mean, what an adventure your life has been at this point. So you've made a whole bunch of I assume you've made friends. It is transient, as you said, like, people fly in and out, but you've landed at this school, you're living in the UK, you've made some friends at this new school. Like, do you fit in? You've obviously done well enough to be able to go to university in America. So, like, academically, you must have done well. Did you, like, have friends and a social group? Did you fit in well?
Well, those are some of the kindest questions anyone has ever asked me. I wish my parents had asked me any of those questions throughout my 4 years at my boarding school. Do you have any friends? I can confidently say I've made three friends.
I was confident going into the question, because you'd already referenced one girl that you went to school with that you're still talking to.
This is true.
I mean, that one came up casually. It doesn't feel like there's too much trauma here. I don't think she's going to be by herself in the corner crying.
It was interesting, because in the very beginning, I would say for the first year and a half, I was so set on going back to Russia that I had only ever spoke to Russians. So my friend group was just Russian people. And so with time, I sort of explored and started talking to people of other nationalities. But it was... Initially, the knee-jerk reaction was just like, create a little Russian community.
And how is that with the American of it all? Because, like, I mean, obviously, traditional rivals, let's say, the Russians and the Americans, two big ones, two superpowers that like to
There's
heads.
A sort of begrudging respect between superpowers, of sort of understanding.
Yes, but they're just like, they're both, we got some different philosophies and ways about but we're both like big dogs, and we've got our own different ways.
Yeah, we're both the best.
Yeah. We both believe that we're the best.
Exactly.
We both have, we're podium finish if it comes to world superpower. Like, we're pretty good.
Exactly.
So, we're both like at this stage just going, China doesn't count. China counts the most, let's be honest. But okay, so is there that, do you carry Russian baggage, I guess, in regard to the fact that you're like in this American education system or going to university in America? Is there any, like, have you been raised on, you know, anti-American tales, or is this like quite an open, you know, exciting opportunity to go and like, you know, live in America and study in America?
So I think historically, even like in now and maybe more so in 10 to 20 years, I will look back at the time that I lived in Russia as a sort of flash of, I guess, like westernization. And now in retrospect, people are critiquing it. And I think it's totally valid to criticize just how Russia adopted capitalism and how destructive it had been for like the general population. But the Russia that I lived in was very open-minded towards the West, very sort of like free market, very like, I don't know, like we had gay people on TV. Like it was a very, very open-minded time, late 90s, early 2000s. And so the Russia that it is now and the Russia it was right before I was born was a place that of stereotypes. But at the exact time that I lived there, it was very, I mean, I'm going to say open to the West. I won't say that it's good or bad. It's just that was the state of it. So the hate that they might have now for the US, they probably had in the Soviet Union and likely have right now, but didn't at the turn of the century.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's, I mean, I do remember that, but because it swung so far back the other way, it feels like a blip that didn't exist now. Like,
yeah.
You know, you just like, oh, it felt like that was the future and the world was opening up and everything was going to be different. And then it actually went back the other way a bit. And obviously, you know, you forget that there was that time where you're like, I mean, I've always had that. I've never met anyone who's been there for anything really. Like I always hear about, you know, somebody be like, oh man, this radio station, like literally people used to do cocaine off the desk. It'd be a party all night long. It was the best. And like, when they stopped doing that, oh, last Thursday, the day before they hired you, that all stopped. They don't do any of that anymore. It's the opposite of that now. Like,
oh God.
You were there.
Yeah. That's what it must have felt like to get a job in banking in the year 2009. Uh-huh. Oh, it just wouldn't be the same, would it? But yeah, I remember that, like the number one, I mean, to this day, people still listen to her, but like the number one rock star in Russia was an openly lesbian woman. And to the point where like, she was like Bruce Springsteen level of big. Like she wasn't underground in any way. She was like on national television, like doing, I don't know, the New Year's Eve ball drop or whatever. Like, everything that I say, I realize sounds completely unrealistic, but that's the Russia I remember.
No, I mean, this is fascinating to me. Like I would ask you a million more questions, but we're in New York. You've gone to university. We're already in America. Is there, I want to know about, like you've gone from like, again, just this life that you're living already by the time that you're what, 18, 19, something like this, 20, like how old are you at this point when you moved to New York to go to university?
18, yeah.
18 years old. Okay. So you've left Russia when you're 14 years old. You've gone to this American boarding school in the United Kingdom. You've made yourself at least three friends. I'm going to say more than that, but at least three. You've got out of your Russian subgroup after the first year. You've studied hard. What were you good at school? Like what were your areas of, like what did you go to New York University to study?
I was intending to study math. Mm-hmm. I immediately realized that I was not smart enough for it. And so I studied computer science.
Okay. So computer science. So did you finish your computer science?
Yeah, okay. I got my degree in computer science. And I think I was at, just as you said, this is so funny that you say that the idea that we stopped doing cocaine last Thursday. I was absolutely sold on the promise of the startup of sort of ball pits, beer Thursdays, margarita Wednesdays, the idea that you wear a hoodie to work and we're going to save the world and we're cool and we skateboard around the office. I was sold on it. I was just drinking the Kool-Aid so hard. And I remember I got an internship at one of those companies the summer before my last year. I got a job offer after I graduated. I got a job offer in London. So I moved to London. I was like, yes, let's go. Let's build a future. And that is, I want to say that's precisely the moment where everyone was like, wait a second. Are they just the same bad guys, but they're just wearing a different outfit. And I was like, God, I was like, you couldn't have given me a year. You couldn't have given me a month. It was like immediately. It's like, that was the same day. They were like, why is their slogan, don't be evil? And I'm like, what? Can we?
Yeah, I mean.
Let's not question it.
It honestly, I mean, Google in particular, because I remember I was on air on radio in Australia on like Triple J, which is the like the youth national youth broadcaster. And I remember when Google started, we were on air and like the possibilities of Google, like the way that it opened up the world, that like knowledge was suddenly democratized and everybody could know everything and we'd be able to access all this information and it would revolutionize everything. And this was a company that came along and they just wanted to like, you know, educate the world and like, you know, give us stuff and make our lives better. And they probably just didn't give us that Maps app so they could track where we were going. And they probably didn't give us that free email so they could read them in the terms and conditions and compile big data on us. And oh no, I've just signed up. Hi, everything's still great here.
That's literally my life.
Yeah, you're the guy who started working at Benson and Hedges the day they've gone, hey, they found out these things aren't good for you. These are terrible. These are. They don't clear up your cough. It's the opposite, they've actually said.
Business as usual. So, yeah.
So you come back to the UK, for this job where you're going to change the world. Like, are you bought into the idea of changing the world, or are you bought into the idea of, you know, beanbags and beer pong and, you know, like the lifestyle of it all? Like, what's the motivation at this point in your life? Where's your head at?
So I'm about to explain what I did for a job. Uh-huh. That being said, I need you to understand that at this point I was 21 years old and my frontal lobe was not complete. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I was hired. I won't say where, but I'll tell you that it's the video platform that radicalizes teenagers. Right. Uh-huh. And so I spent about 6 years working for the video platform that radicalizes teenagers, going into sort of the post-Soviet space, because obviously I was fluent in Russian, and selling people the dream and the idea that they, even though they didn't have free speech and freedom of press, the video platform that radicalizes teenagers will give them the chance to create their own free press, which is a gorgeous dream to sell before you realize that if they actually did that, they will A, be imprisoned in the countries that they're doing that in, and B, we will never do anything about it. Oh, also C, if the government of that country asks us to take these videos down, we'll happily do it because we want to stay live in that country.
And so,
did you think that this is where this interview would go?
I mean, it's not. It's I'm pretty fun that it has. Like, I mean, you are a very fascinating person. You have lived a fucking life. Like, this is so much. I feel like I'm watching one of those, like, based on a true story series on, like, you know, and, you know, you're like, you get to the third episode and you think you know what it's about.
Yeah.
And then there's just a whole episode that's about something else completely. And you're like, oh my God, I don't know what this show is. Like, there's so many things going on.
So I'd be like flying into Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan and Belarus and just being like, your government won't let you say what you want on TV. We have a little opportunity for you. And then obviously I didn't even consider all the consequences of everything that I was saying at the time. And it was just, it's just the textbook sort of, if the promise sounds too good to be true, it is.
We've looked at your local teenagers and don't believe they're being radicalized like effectively enough. And we have a platform that we think you really might enjoy.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. You're radicalizing them. Teenagers have been radicalized throughout history. That platform did not invent radicalizing teenagers.
No.
They just.
But it's scalable. It's effective.
they just scaled it. That's correct. They didn't invent it. They just nailed it.
Yeah.
They cracked the algorithm.
Yeah.
Really had been on, they were standing on the shoulders of giants, but they bloody did it. And then they apparently exported it to the world. They sent people across borders to recruit people into the infrastructure.
You guys got to check it out.
Oh, fuck, man. That is so, so great. Okay, so you do this for how long?
About 6 years, just under.
Uh-huh. All right. And so why does that end? When do you start doing comedy? Is comedy adjacent to this?
Yeah, so I did my first 3 hours still working there.
Okay. So, all right, so where do you start doing comedy then? Let's get the comedy origin story, like, because it's been bananas so far, so let's find out how comedy comes in. We haven't even got to comedy yet. That's like the best thing about this is there's so much already and we haven't even got to comedy. The thing that mostly when I don't know someone is on the podcast, it mostly ends up being a conversation about comedy and their comedy because that's normally how I know them. You've just blown the first 35 minutes of this biggest Mission Impossible style, previously on. Like, this is so good. But anyway, now that we've got to comedy, where does comedy start?
Oh, fine.
Where and why does comedy start?
When
do you first think of it? Before we get to you doing it, when does comedy come into your life, become an idea in your mind of something that you might be going to do?
So I truly think that I was obviously growing up on a series of historical sweet spots, as we've just discussed about Google not being cool anymore. But I think there was a sweet spot in high school where we all got access to video editing software, like Windows Movie Maker and iMovie. And we're all teenagers and YouTube was just starting. And we're all like, maybe we can make videos. And it was just becoming accessible enough for us to start doing it ourselves. And so like everybody was doing little sketches, little skits, filming them. And that was the first time people could do it and it was really, really accessible. And so I was doing lots of videos in high school just for us. Like in my friend group, it would just be a fun thing to do. Like, what are we going to do on a Sunday? Let's do a bunch of sketches. And so when I moved to New York and found out about UCB, which is the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, and that they had classes, I took every class they offered. I was doing sketch. I was doing improv, anything they offered.
And what era of UCB is this? Like, who's in like the... Who are the kind of improv stars that are in and out of UCB?
I remember watching Sasheer Zamata's, one of her last sketch shows right before she got SNL. And I remember seeing her on that stage. And I'm sure everyone in that audience, including the bookers for SNL, were like, oh, this girl's a star. We need to get her on TV. Uh-huh. And that was an amazing moment because I was like, I know that this is probably like one of the last times I will see someone that talented at this level of a show.
I mean, that's such a, particularly New York UCB experience, right? It's like there is that time of seeing someone graduate, particularly to Saturday Night Live. I mean, Mike Birbiglia wrote a whole movie about this very thing, right? So it's kind of become part of the mythology, the lexicon around it. So were you aware of UCB? Was that something that was already on your radar or did you kind of stumble into that world?
I knew about it because it was like every sitcom I watched on the Wikipedia pages, it would be like, they start at UCB or they started UCB. And again, I think that's another moment that the second I left New York, people were like, oh, it's actually a cult that's taking people's money. And I was like, guys, come on, let me catch one break. But I do remember that towards the end of it, like the summer before I moved to London, I had to like work for them. I think like an 8-hour day for free, standing on my feet the entire time, like 8 or 10. I just remember being like, something's not right here.
No, it's, we can't have nice things. That's unfortunately the story of this world. Everything's wrong and broken. Don't set your expectations too high. Don't buy into anything too much. There's probably something wrong with it that you haven't discovered yet, I'd imagine. So, All right. So, but you've done these classes, you've done improv, like you do, is it like long form, short form? How much stage time are you doing? Are you doing individual stuff? Are you doing sketch? Like what world are you operating in at this point as a performer?
At this point, I have no interest in performing whatsoever. All I want to do is write sketches. For me, sketch was king.
So that's it? Really? So you didn't you didn't actually want to be a performer yourself? Okay, so you're studying this. You do these UCB classes. You end up back in the UK.
Yeah.
So what happens next?
So two things happen. First of all, I'm like, I want to keep doing sketch. I want to start a sketch team. I really enjoy writing sketches. That's all I want to do. So my thinking was I will start doing stand-up to meet people. The second I meet them, I'll start a sketch team and then get the fuck out of stand-up. Again, obviously, first time I'm on stage, I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. I'm never sharing the stage with anyone else. Fuck you. But then another thing that happened, and this is something that happens systematically in my life, is that I tell enough people in my life that I'm going to do stand-up that a couple months later they come back and they're like, oh, hey, did you ever try that? And the sheer embarrassment makes me book open spots. I've done this with so many things in my life. A couple years ago, I was like, I'm gonna do a master's. And then a couple of people came back to me like a year later being like, how's that master's? And that, out of sheer embarrassment, I applied and did a master's degree.
Interesting. Okay.
So that's a really cool psychological trick that I could recommend to you, Will. Tell enough people a lie that you're too scared to fess up to.
It's nice that you've told me this, a person that you met like on the computer 40 minutes ago. Have you ever told a therapist that? That feels like something you need to unpack. That you did a whole master's just to prevent being embarrassed about people bringing up the fact that you hadn't done your master's yet. No, that seems fine. To put the positive spin on that, of course, which is, and I do this a bit myself, which is if I say it enough out loud, this is something that I do want to do, but I have not found the motivation to do so by putting it out into the universe in whatever way, even if it's in a negative, I need to be.
It's manifesting, Will. It's manifesting. That's what
it's just cool manifesting. You're doing cool manifesting where you like essentially put something out there, then get bullied into doing it. You're like, you know, it's not vision boards, but it's your spin on it, right?
Yeah.
Put it out into the universe. The universe will hear and bully you into it. So
exactly. That's
okay.
Exactly
it. So where do you start doing stand-up then? When's your first gig? When's this first show?
First gig, I want to say it's 2014. It's in like a basement of a pub. I think
open
like
mic.
London is
like
so,
just like classic open London open mic. Is it have you been to this gig before? Did you go and stake it out, see if, you know, or is it literally just I prepared my bit and I'm just going to roll in and do it?
Bottom of a pub, no one other than other comics in the audience. Barely anyone there. No one laughed. It was just your bog standard open mic.
And what are you talking about at this point? 5 minutes, you know, I assume, right?
Yeah.
Like I assume it's something like 5 minutes around that. So what are you talking about in your first 5 minutes?
Literally just reading old tweets, just one-liners. Just this is a tweet that I tweeted in the last 3 years.
And what were you tweeting about during that time? Like, what
I was
would
tweeting little
the,
jokes. I was tweeting little
yeah,
jokes.
But
I thought they were
fun.
Yeah,
when you say, yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm interrogating you. And
No,
my job. That is the job of the KGB at the border when you try to go back to Russia. But I'm just curious about like what the subject matters. Were they wordplay jokes? Were they like pop culture jokes? Were they topical jokes? Were they like old school set up punchline jokes? Like what sort of your material were you writing?
I think lots of puns, lots of pop culture stuff, a little bit of sex stuff. I remember to this day, I actually am very proud of this joke. The joke was, do her pleasure condoms break on purpose? Cause the only pleasure a woman can know is the joy of motherhood.
I mean, that's
which
a
is
pretty good joke.
Which that's is like good, for a tweet by a 19-year-old, I was like, this isn't bad.
Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty, like, there's a lot going on in that joke.
Yeah.
Like
it's very wordy.
Yeah. No, but in a way that clues you to the fact that you're not saying what you think you're saying, right?
Like,
fun. That's a fun joke. That's a good,
Thank you, Will.
Definitely stand by that. Yeah, you needed that. You needed me to give you that tick of approval. So you're just reading these tweets to other comedians, essentially, the best audience of all time.
Yeah.
So what makes you do it again? Because when I hear stories like this, so when I first started, of course, like I played some of those gigs, but they weren't my origin story gigs. Like there was actually in Melbourne, you know, 30 years ago, a pretty solid Sunday open mic that would get, I guess, like 100, 150 people in.
Who were real audience members.
Real audience members, $5, you know, two halves. People would probably normally come in for one half or the other half. It was out the back of the pub on a Sunday afternoon. So, you know, people were kind of recovering. Like it was a good I think people would come for recovery, you know, have a beer, watch some comedy, kind of recover from Saturday night vibe. But they were good audiences, you know, like particularly for open mic. And there was a decent MC and a decent headliner, you know, probably like middles in any other sphere, but, you know, knew what they were doing, you know. And so I understand why I kept doing it, because the initial experience, regardless of my talent towards it, was fun. It was good. It was like, you're like, this is going well. But I think if my initial experience had been reading my tweets to other comedians in a basement, I'm not sure. Like, I mean, I've had those sort of gigs since, but it's not how I started. How do you keep momentum from something like that? How does that go, oh my God, I've got to keep doing this. This is so much fun.
I mean, I always think about this. I think about it as, in order to be a good comedian, and that's not to say that I think I am a good comedian, but it's just something that I've noticed, is that you need to be self-aware enough to know you're bombing and that you need to improve and what works and what doesn't work. But you also need to be delusional enough to keep going, right? Because if you just have the self-awareness, you will never do stand-up again, because if you bombed once, you'd be like, why would I ever want to do that? Whereas if you're just delusional, you're never going to improve, because you're just going to not realize that you're bombing. And so I think it is my delusion that guided me through, but my self-awareness that made me better.
Yeah. I mean, that's very mature and like, I mean, you've got to the heart of it. That's a very simple way of saying what is essentially the truth of everybody's experience through this. Like it is some version of that, and you're dialing one up more than the other. At your best or worst, like what's working in that balance between delusion and self-awareness? Because I do think that you need both, but you also need to be aware of how much that you're bringing to each occasion. Like, am I bringing enough delusion? Am I bringing enough self-awareness? Like, when you're at your best and worst, what are the sort of mixes? Like, what goes right or wrong to, you know, mean that, oh, you know, this is all absolutely firing. There's like this amount of delusion and this amount of self-awareness versus, oh, this is me in a bad place because one or the other has been turned up too much.
I think when it comes to me at my most self-aware, I would guess like that's when I'm most insecure. And that means that I'm not taking any risks and I'm not trying any new material. And that is a creative rut. So that's just me doing stuff I know works from 3 years ago. And then I sort of beat myself up, even if it goes well, because it's like, of course it went well, because it's from 3 years ago and you took no risks and tried nothing new. And I guess me at my most delusional is when I'm doing a work in progress where all I've written down is just a list of words. And I just hope that people get what it is in my brain and laugh at the idea of a joke as opposed to the joke itself.
Where does the word come from? Like in your process, like if you're talking about trial shows, and this is like now modern day trial shows, not back when you're like, here's my big story that I have to tell. Like this is more, you know, here's what I'm doing now. Like where are those words that become the words in the trial show? Where do they come from? Are you sitting down and writing? Are you observing the world? Are you just like, did the ideas come to you in the shower or while you swim? Like, you know, where are the words coming from?
So, I mean, usually I work off a story. So all of my shows so far have been at least like narrative arcs of some kind. And so then I'm kind of writing to brief. And then a lot of the time it comes from like conversations I have with people. I love a little hypothetical scenario. And that's one of my favorite things to do, just to contemplate. What do you mean?
Give me an example of that. I also love a hypothetical scenario, but what are we talking about here?
Let's say 2 days ago, I was at dinner with my boyfriend, and we were discussing what would be, because like it's annoying how predictable people are when they get rich. Like, oh, you're going to get a nice car and a nice house. I want you to spend your fortune on something more ridiculous. Like, I think the actor Terrence Howard spent a lot of money creating a new type of math where he would prove 2 + 2 = 5. That's incredible. That's what I want people to spend money on. Peter Thiel, the guy who founded PayPal, is doing doping Olympics where athletes are allowed to dope. That's where you should be putting your money towards. Do you know what I mean? And so we were just talking about what's a fun way to spend your fortune as opposed to a very predictable sort of like race car and mistress route.
Okay. Well, firstly, I'm getting a lot more insight into, you know, the old going across borders, selling the internet to people, like side of your personality from this hypothetical scenario where you've listed Peter Thiel, notorious great guy, and he's great.
No,
he's great plan.
Terrible people. Rich people are bad, Will.
To get everyone full of performance-enhancing drugs and then have their hearts explode on television for our pleasure. Okay. Yeah, I see.
No, because now you know that billionaire who had a son just to take his blood from so he could stay young forever?
Yeah.
Are there just going to be free-roaming blood sons at the doping Olympics? I need to know.
I mean, like the guides who guide blind runners in marathons, like a little, or like ball boys at the tennis, just running out a little bag of plasma to the, like on the sidelines, just
ready to go.
Okay, so. Autobiographical storytelling. You're coming to Australia. Let's talk about what you're going to do in Australia. Like, have you been to Australia before to do comedy? Have you been out to Australia before to do stand-up?
Yeah, I did Sydney Comedy Festival and Perth Comedy Festival, and I had the absolute time of my life. I got a tattoo. That's how much fun I had.
Shut up. What sort of tattoo did you get?
It's a tattoo of a Golden Gay Time ice cream.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I mean,
do you want to see it?
Wow. I mean, I don't know. Do I want to see it? Yeah,
it's
sure.
It's on my... Sorry. It's
oh, my God.
I'm so sorry. This is so weird. But yeah, me and my friend Helen Bauer, we both got Golden Gay Time tattoos.
Wow.
We love Australia.
Okay. I mean, wow. So you came out and you did Sydney Comedy Festival. And
I realize I met you an hour
Festival.
Ago and now I've just shown you my foot via webcam. I'm so sorry, Will.
We've got deep on this already. It's fine. We've been all over the place. It's good. No, I mean, I find it hard to, like, what I've realized, I've talked to my therapist a lot about this, which is that I really love interacting with people, but I don't like I'm so bad with like social situations and social anxiety and like, you know, so like I love to supercharge, you know, all my interactions that I have with humans in like, I'm just like, this is great. Let's talk about everything. Show me your tattoo. We'll talk about like life. We'll really break it down. And then you know what? We don't need to run into each other again for a couple of years. We've caught up. Everything's fine. I feel like we
this
know each other,
Yeah.
So, all right. So you came out to Australia. When you were coming out and doing those shows in Perth and Sydney, were you doing like an hour long show or were you doing like a best of jokes sort of situation? Like what actual shows were you doing when you came out last time?
Did a little bit of both. I did an hour that I did at the 2022 Fringe and then I just did some lineup shows as well.
Okay. All right.
Just to get introduced.
And now this time you're coming back and doing more cities though, right? Like what are you doing this time?
Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane and Perth.
Okay. All right. Okay. So what was it that you liked about Australia? Like, I mean, again, I feel bad because like we didn't run into each other or anything in any of those places, did we? Like we haven't met previously and I've forgotten it or anything like that, have we? Because that is my worst nightmare in the world.
It would be completely okay if you did. It's totally fine.
I know, but it's just one of those things where I'm like, oh, okay, well, she's been here before. I thought, you know, like if she's come all the way to your country, you've not paid attention,
you know. It's perfectly okay.
Okay, so what was it about Australia that you liked when you came out here to do comedy?
I mean, I don't want to sound cliche, but it was just the lifestyle, obviously. Mm-hmm. The idea that you have a gorgeous city on like a resort level beach and the beach is clean and you have free showers on that beach, that's mental. That's unreal.
Okay. Yeah. There is something about that. I was at that
you
beach.
You can't tell me
I
that,
was
like,
at that beach that you were referencing like today. So I like, it's a hard thing to refute. And I do sometimes when I am at that beach that is, you know, 15 minutes drive from the middle of the city, you think, yeah, this is good. Like a lot of the time, I worked in America for years, and often I have like friends of mine who like I worked with. I was just talking to one of the Moshe Kasher on this show last week.
Oh my God,
he was like, he's like, are you coming back to do gigs? And I said, I'm not. And I said, I mean, maybe at some stage, but not in the way that I used to 6 months of the year. Like I said, because have you taken a look at America? There's a lot going on at the moment that I don't feel like I need. I don't feel like I'm going to help. I feel like I'm only going to add to your worries. You know what I mean? And secondly, like I've had a good look at where I'm from, and like I think sometimes when you grow up somewhere, like, I mean, well, you've grown up in a bunch of different places. Your relationship to each of those places, you know, can often change over the years. You know, if you grow up somewhere, you can start to think that it's, you know, the cities are small, or that you need to adventure overseas is a big Australian thing to, you know, kind of make your mark on the world. And it can often mean that you end up forgetting how good you have it in Australia sometimes, because Australia, like particularly as a comedian too, you know, there's not that market that, you know, obviously you have in the UK and the US where you can become like, you know, a huge star. There's not necessarily that capacity, but the actual standard of comedy, like, I mean, there's so many good comedians who've come out of Australia or who just work in Australia who aren't known as international names, but are just like really great Australian comedians. So, okay. So you come out to Australia, you like the beach, you get the vibe, you go to Perth and Sydney, which is your two cities most likely to like the beach. So you're going to get tested a little bit more this next time in, because you're going to go to some places where, you know, they're not beach forward. They're not going to be beach first. What were the comedy audiences like is what I want to know. Who was coming out to see you, and what were they like as comedy audiences?
Wait, can I tell you a formative experience that I had on the Bondi to Coogee beach, walk?
Uh-huh.
I was doing it in the rain. And there was there's a wave pool on that route that's like women only. And I went, and there was only one old lady in it swimming, and we didn't acknowledge each other. And I had this realization that I was like, that's just me in the future. It was the most beautiful thing that ever happened.
Oh my God.
I mean, I was time traveling.
You know what I love about that is I will literally tomorrow walk past where that happened, and I'll be able to go, oh, look at that. Like, that's a connection from across the world to like something that I can literally experience tomorrow. So that's fun.
Old Olga is doing well.
I mean, if old Olga, this is okay. You like hypotheticals, and this is right in my area. So let's jump off here for a second. So say it is old Olga. Like it's Olga, and she's in the corner. You like a pun as well. So we'll go with Olga. I like that. So Olga is over in the corner, and Olga swims over to you and says, it's me. I'm you.
Yeah.
It's me. It's you. I'm you from the future. I've come back from the future. What do you want to know? I can only tell you three things.
This is good.
How many years in the future was she from where, like, if you were going to just say this, or you can pick an amount of years if you'd like.
Yeah, I think she was double my age. She was maybe in her early 60s, and I'm in my early 30s.
Okay. So, yeah, okay, great. So that gives us some parameters of this. So not even that old Olga is swimming over. And she said,
middle-aged Olga. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so she swims over and she says, I'm from the future, 30 years in the future. I've been given the opportunity to come back and meet you here today. I have a small window and I'm only allowed to impart three pieces of knowledge about the future to you. One, I'm allowed to tell you one personal thing about your own life. I'm allowed to tell you one thing about the world, the planet or the state of the world, and then you have one question of your own that you can use. So they're the three questions that you're allowed to go with. So which one do you want to go first? You can have your free choice or you can have your personal or your world question that you want to ask.
Okay, I mean, obviously all of my questions are going to be so cliche, but let's go with personal first.
Okay, personal first. You have one question though, remember? Like, and you can't trick me with some big long-winded, like I'm going to rope in a whole bunch of things. You have to just like ask what you think is the most important question. Now, here's some good news. You know you've at least made it another like 30 years, so you don't need to ask anything around that because you're like, you're there, you've swum over. You can use your eyes to make some of this up, you know? But what are you going to ask?
Am I still friends with my best friend, Phil?
Oh, yeah, okay. I feel good about that. Even I feel good about that, not knowing Phil.
you think Phil and I are going to be best friends still?
Yeah, I feel like. As long as you and Phil are both around, I feel like you and Phil will still be very close.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Because Phil and I met in high school and we've lived together since I moved back to London. He's literally next door. So I hope he's not going anywhere.
Well, I mean, okay. So that's good though. I mean, that's a level of... So Phil and you met Phil at this like American London high school, right? Okay. So, and Phil is a man. Phil a man? Yes. Okay. And so you've lived with Phil for all this time.
Yeah.
Does Phil have a partner?
Yes.
And so obviously Phil's partner's fine with the fact that you two are best friends as well. Has there ever been like a time that either of you have had, like, and I'm assuming that your partner is fine with it, and I'm assuming from your answer that for this your question you've asked old you, that if he wasn't, like, the question would still be about Phil and you just forget about what was going on there. But has there ever been, like, is there like having a close male-female friendship that's so long-lasting and so, like, caught up in each other's lives? Like, has it been problematic for romantic partners on either side?
Well, Phil is gay, so I hope that it hasn't.
Well, I mean,
worried anybody?
It doesn't necessarily. I mean, I'm not here to.
I love the idea of my boyfriend listening to this podcast and it's seeding fear and anger in him.
I mean, I wasn't suggesting that. I mean, the fear and anger might have come from you could have asked about me, how I was, but you didn't bring that up. It was all about Phil. You wanted to know Phil and
no,
you
I think
until
understand.
Time.
Yeah. I think he'd understand.
All right, so that's the personal one, Phil. Secondly, you've got a question about the world. What are you going to ask?
You want to be original, don't you? You want to be original.
I don't know, do you? It's just what you want to know.
Is Eurovision still a thing?
Oh my God, is Eurovision still a thing? And that's enough that it's just still a thing. Like, you didn't need to know whether it was good or whether England had won Eurovision or, like, I mean, whoever. Who do you follow in Eurovision? Do you follow a country?
Oh, no. I'm always out for the tiny ones, like San Marino and stuff.
Yeah.
I think that there's just something really maybe idealistic and very naive about things that, like, keep happening through wars and through the ages, like the fact that we kept the Olympics going. You know what I mean?
I do. I feel like that's actually a good question. Like, well, it's a good question if they say yes.
Yeah.
Right? If they say yes, then, or if you say yes, then that's a good answer that gives you clues about the rest of the world because you're like, Eurovision's still going.
Yeah.
Like,
so Europe more or less is still a thing.
Yeah, right? Like, so that gives you some clues about the state of things. Unless you from the future is like, yeah, it's still going, but it's a lot more like the Squid Game now as well. Like, there's this new element that
there's not much singing left.
Yeah, it's like mostly wars and stuff, but they do still sing. Like, they kept that. And the costumes are amazing. Like, we still... Yeah. Okay.
But they are singing at gunpoint. Yeah.
All right. Okay. They're both good questions, though.
Like, okay. So what are yours? What are yours?
No, what's yours? You've got a third question. You've got a random question you're allowed to ask just about anything. So, I mean, you've already asked about Eurovision and Phil. Does Phil like
I'm not sure I care about anything other than that. Sorry.
Does Phil like Eurovision? Is Phil a Eurovision fan?
Oh, I think so. I mean, not like living for it, but I think it's, as a social occasion, it's very, very fun.
Yeah. But Phil would be interested to know that Eurovision was still like, because you're going to, like, there's a part of you that's like, you're coming home.
Don't make me choose between Phil and Eurovision.
I'm not. I mean, imagine. Okay. No. I know. My thing was more like, you're going to come home and tell somebody about this interaction, right? And you live with Phil. I feel like you've done great because you come back to London, right? You're like, you're never going to believe, you need to tell somebody what's happened.
Right.
You're never going to believe what's happened. I'm in this like women only wave pool on the Bondi to Coogee walk. I've been approached by me from the future. She swam over to me. I 100% believe this is true.
Yeah.
I offered this scenario where I got these three questions. Phil's immediately going to ask, well, what did you ask? First answer was, am I still friends with Phil? I mean, this is perfect scenario for coming home to tell Phil.
Yeah, that's
about
really
this.
Heartwarming. Like, you know what I mean? That's like, really heartwarming.
This is a beautiful moment already. Then the second one is Eurovision still a thing? So that's why I asked if Phil was like, I just wondered what Phil's level of interest in you asking.
Yeah, so far two for two. Phil is as invested in the answers as I am.
Okay,
I think.
Yeah, cool. All right, okay. So you've come back with a good anecdote as well, is what I'm saying. All right, so third question.
My third question, I guess, I mean, at the risk of sounding a bit, I guess, narcissistic, I would be curious to know whether I was able to like live 100 lifetimes, because I think like what's been, I've been happy with in my life is like how much change I've had. Similarly to my imperfect father, who was a politician, game show host, and then enemy of state, I really hope to wear a lot of hats in the following 30 years. Comedy has never felt permanent to me, and I think that's the sort of pragmatic work ethic Soviet brain speaking to me, saying that freelancing in general is so volatile that you can never really fully depend on it. So it's always been like, oh, this is fun for now, because obviously this isn't forever. I've never felt like it never felt like sturdy enough to be a life. And then the second thing is like, I remember at a very impressionable age, I listened a lot to the Pete Holmes podcast, and on it, he said that you have to live a life worth commenting on. And to me, comedy has never felt like the thing. It felt like the vessel to process the thing. So like my first show was about my dad. My second show was about doing computer science at university. My third show was about immigrating. My latest show, the one that I'm bringing to Australia, is about my master's degree. And so for me, it's never the thing. It's the way to process and to deliver and to package the life I'm living, as opposed to the life I'm living.
Yes. I ask people on this show, Olga, if they have a life philosophy of any kind. That's the central conceit, you know, the hook, if you will, of what it is that we are doing here. And so I'm going to ask you that same question. Do you have a life philosophy of any kind?
I knew this question was coming.
Oh my God. That was like a sharp intake of breath for someone who we've been having a lovely philosophical chat for like 70 or 80 minutes, you know, and it felt like, look, there'd been a couple of technical issues. People hopefully have not heard the technical issues. That's the wonder of, you know, pre-recording things. And it's probably just been going very smoothly to them. But we had a moment, came off the back of a technical issue, and my head was in a different place. And I really just was like, you know what, I'm going to ask just the question a bit out of the blue. It's come a little bit out of the blue, just quickly just went into it. And I hope that in this little bit of padding that I've done here, Olga, it's giving you an opportunity to regroup, feel comfortable, and be ready to answer my question. Do you have a life philosophy of any kind?
I think I'll repeat what I just said because I do live by it, and that is to live a life worth commenting on.
Right. Live a life worth commenting on. Now, so I love it. It's a great starting point, but what does it actually mean? Because everything could be worth commenting on. So let's just explore it a little bit more. Let's find out what you mean by worth commenting on. Like what is best for commenting on, I guess, is a good starting point, because often, like as a comedian, like if something goes really badly or embarrassingly or any of those sort of things, it can often be good comedic fodder. But when you say live a life worth commenting on, what do you mean by that?
Well, I have to give credit where credit is due, because I did hear it from Pete Holmes when I was like 19 or something, and that
you get full credit. I think
it's very hard to talk about it without feeling like I'm speaking in platitudes, but it's like, it's saying yes to things. It's walking towards fear. It's staying curious. It's a sort of, I guess, healthy restlessness.
Okay. Like, they were all excellent words that have got me no closer to understanding what it is
right.
that you mean by this. Like, and I don't mean that in, by the way, I only mean that in the, you know, very teasing way that I just, like, I don't quite understand, you know, that I do want to understand a little bit more about on a day to, I just guess, how does that actually mean that you live your life? Like, give me an example of something that would be of that philosophy, like a choice you might have made because you thought this is something that is worth commenting on. At the very least, it is something that is worth commenting on.
Okay, I'm not going to tell you what happened because I feel like your listeners can come and see my show.
Oh, yeah, good. That's good. That's a good hook.
But last year I went to a wedding and I met a man at this wedding. The wedding was in New Zealand. I live in the United Kingdom. Uh-huh. And after quote unquote meeting at this wedding, we thought it would be really fun to see each other again. Uh-huh. But he lived in New Zealand and I live in the United Kingdom. So the only logical solution was to meet 3 months later in Tokyo, Japan.
Aha. Uh-huh. Great.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's, yeah. I mean, that is a great example. That's like, not only is that a great example of the sort of thing that I was looking for, much better than your, you know, stitch pillowcases slogans that you rolled out to me like I was some chump. It's like, just keep saying words and you'll stop asking me questions. It's not how it works. So, but no, I mean, this, but it's also, what a great hook for the show. So when you do something like this, this is where I am really interested. When you make a decision like that, is that just, well, this is grand life philosophy is have an adventure. At the very least, you get like a good story out of having the adventure. Is there a mm-hmm. part of you that thinks, regardless of how this goes, this will be a show? Like, do you know that before you set out on the adventure, or do you only in retrospect? Like, I mean, how much of it is you saying, I'm going to open myself up to the universe of experience and just assume that in that something that will be happen that will be worth doing a show about? Or does it require there to be some sort of instigating incident, you know, in the trip for, like, how does something like that start? How planned are you in opening yourself up to it as a show idea?
So, okay, well, I think I've only just formed this in my head, so I apologize if it's a bit clunky, but much like I was just saying that, like, comedy to me is a vessel. It's a way to process things. It's a way to deliver things. It's a way to package experiences. The thing that comedy has provided for me is it's a tool, because I'll always have it as a fallback, and that makes me more fearless. So before, I would be hesitant to say yes to things because I would be scared that the experience would be negative, or I'd be embarrassed, or I wouldn't like it, or it wouldn't be to my taste. But now I'm less hesitant to say no, because even if I do have a negative experience, it will be something to process in the comedy tool.
You know what I love is this actually in the 10 years of doing this show might be one of the best things I've ever heard anybody
no.
say. Like it honestly, I mean, I know that you were saying you're just making it up as you go, but I think you've stumbled upon something fucking brilliant because I do think that comedy is a great thing to do to get you to be able to not care as much about the consequences of other things.
Absolutely.
Like by the very act of knowing that if shit goes, like the amount of times I've gone into an emergency, a medical situation, something fucked up in my life, and the thing that has comforted me hasn't been like a religion or a, like a, you know, set of principles. It's the fact that, oh, well, this will make a good like joke at some point. Like it's comedy that has got me the knowledge that the worst experience, like I often think about it, like with normal people, I'm like, what do you do when something goes really badly or goes wrong? Like I, you know, had to go in for a medical procedure recently and somebody asked me if I was nervous and I was like, what, like nervous that there'll be nothing wrong with me and I'll lose fucking 15 minutes from my show. Like, like mate, if they find a lump, I'll find an award, you know. Like, but, you know, you've always got that sort of as a weird, I mean, I've never heard anyone put it like that, but that I love that. I think that's going to reframe. Look, we said at the start of this that all we had was an ambition that you would talk about something you hadn't talked about before and I would hear something that I hadn't heard before. And I feel like that we imagined both those things. I mean, you know, we've danced around some other areas to get there, but we've bloody got there, I think. So, all right, you like a hypothetical, but before we get to the hypotheticals, I'm going to just ask you the standard questions that I ask people on this show. So the first one is, what do you think happens when we die?
Oh God, sorry. I know that this is a standard question. I think we just die.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think, the most sensible of all answers, honestly, to the question. But
I hope that before you die, you see a trailer to your own life.
Really? Like just the trailer?
Just the trailer. Just like a supercut.
Yeah, right. Like, but like a modern trailer where they like spoil everything and it goes for three and a half minutes or
exactly.
Like a, oh yeah, okay. So you want, yeah, all the
Olga Koch was a little girl who was born in St. Petersburg in 1992. What happened next will blow your mind.
Oh man, I love it. Okay, so, when do you think that you came to that conclusion? Was there like a point? Was there ever a point in your life where you had like another system of belief that you had to disavow to get to the point where you believe that you probably just die?
I never believed otherwise, so it has never been scary to me. Again, post-Soviet thinking, religion wasn't a big thing. So it's never it was never like I grew up thinking heaven was real and then realized that it wasn't real. I never thought heaven was real in the first place.
It just never was something. And how aware of religion, like, were you? Like, I mean, I don't know enough about, I mean, I know it isn't a big thing there, but like how aware of religion in general were you growing up?
It was around, but especially in the 90s and 2000s, but it was obviously post the Soviet Union, but it was adopted by adults. And so in adult age, that meant just sort of adopting the lifestyle. So we're like, oh, let's do Easter or let's do Christmas. Less so, let's really believe in it.
Okay. Well, that's the best way. They're all the best bits of it anyway.
Yeah.
So might as well get on board with that. Maybe you're of an age that it is an if rather than a when, but when you die, hopefully a very long time away. And
at least into my early 60s.
I mean, at the very least, based on the hypothetical already posited in this episode. So let's just say, you know, you live hopefully very comfortably in your life. You achieve a bunch of your dreams. You have your fair share of setbacks. Like, how would you like your life to be commemorated? Is it important to you to be remembered? Are you a person who... yeah, thinks of yourself as being part of like a bigger story? Like, do you care about any of that at all? Like, do you believe in the right to be forgotten? Like, would you like a big funeral? Do you want people to make, you know, big glorious speeches about how wonderful your impact was? Or do you like the idea of just going, well, that's me done and everybody else can move on? Like, what is it that you think about when you think about death?
First of all, I obviously want all of my ex-boyfriends at my funeral crying inconsolably. Still I'm very alive. Serious about this.
You want
I
them
hope,
all to be still alive. You hope yeah. you outlive all your ex-boyfriends.
I hope they outlive me so they can mourn me.
Oh, sorry. So they can mourn you. Yeah, that's what I mean. You die before all of them so that they can. But how do you know that they're mourning you at that point? Like, I mean, they might be laughing that they won, right? Like that you're gone and
no, I'll die hot, so I'll forever in their minds be hot. I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't know. They'll all bond together over the fact that you were really like wouldn't let them go and seemed to take your death as a real personal opportunity to go. Like, but I don't even know why she invited us if she doesn't want us here. Oh no, she wanted you here. But yeah, okay. So all your ex-boyfriends are there mourning you, mourning the loss of the you know,
love
the,
of their
the
life,
greatest love that they ever knew.
Mm-hmm.
And you like living in a world where these men have not been able to move on with their lives and they've been ruined by coming into contact with you, that they haven't been able to find their own happiness, even though I hope that you in this scenario have found your own happiness. You've been able to move on with your life, but you still need them to not be able to move on with their lives?
Their obsession with me is not the top of the priority list, but it is not unpleasant as a thought.
Okay. Yeah, right. Okay. So the fact that they, yes, right. So it's not, you'd like, maybe they haven't been thinking about you constantly every day, but when they all arrive at the funeral, they realize that she was the one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that feels realistic. That's, what, if anything, quite modest. But I think
I was talking it back down a bit. I felt a little bit too like not only were you happy, but the only way you were happy was ruining all these other people's lives because they were never able to give up on something that you had moved on from. Like, I mean, I'm just getting an insight. Is that where we're at? Is that
if only there was a German word for it. When I was at university, I interned at MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
Yes.
And I got like obsessed with the idea of a retrospective. Like, so in a perfect world, if it were up to me, my life will be commemorated in a retrospective at a museum of art of your choosing, but not necessarily my life individually. I think I would like it to commemorate all the stand-up comedians that started in the same sort of graduating year as me in London. Because I think there's a group that started around the same time that I would say is like pre-pandemic, but sort of post-DVD.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I mean, I do. Like, you will have just lost a little bit of the audience, but there was a... I mean, I assume you're talking like also post-DVD comedy boom, you know, rather than just like, you know, DVD, the technology.
But the idea that like it sort of special overtook the DVD special.
That's right. And that the DVD special was, particularly in the UK, such a huge thing where, you know, comedians made their entire careers on selling millions and millions of DVDs. Like it was, you know. The game changed again. It's been more accessible. You know, people can post on any – there are many streaming platforms that are available for people to be able to post material on these days. Some of them won't even radicalize your teenagers. But, like, you know, the good one actually probably will. The best one to put it on probably will. So you're going to have to deal with that. But anyway, okay, so – what do you want them to be saying about you in this moment? What, like when they think back on what you've achieved, you know, as a person or a professional, you know, at this time that everybody is celebrating you, what are they saying? What is it that they are, you know, what do you want to be remembered for?
Well, if I'm still in the sort of vein of the commemorating of this movement of comedians.
Yeah, I think so. Like, I mean, we've set the scene. They've all come along. Like, you know, it's essentially a room full of your generation of comedians and all your ex-lovers. I don't know if there's any crossovers between those two groups, but regardless.
Like, well, there'll be speculation in the wall text, Will. Oh, there will be speculation in the wall text. Frequent collaborator and rumored lover.
Just which side of the church? That's all we're asking. Which side? Right. So how are they remembering you? What is their, like, what, I mean, what are you hoping? How is how they remember you?
If I'm talking about me specifically, yeah. I think I would really, really enjoy it if people thought that I explained big concepts in a funny way.
Okay.
Because, so I have a radio show called OK Computer, which is like just taking computer science concepts and explaining them in, I really hope, a funny and I really hope not condescending way. And I'm just like generally passionate about science communication in a way that is just making people feel smart without making people feel stupid. Does that make sense?
This is so hard for me to bring up, but in Australia, there was this band called Radiohead and they had like an album that was called... Probably didn't go to
never
the UK, but
never heard of it. Never heard of it.
This is a tough moment. Yeah, no, yes, I understand. Thank you. all right, so you've lived your life. People are commemorating you.
Yeah.
We're sitting around and we're talking about the best piece of advice or the worst piece of advice that we've ever received in our life. What is either the best or worst, or both, if you happen to remember? I love bad advice, but often if it's bad, people forget it. But particularly when it comes to comedy, like generations of comedians, if you're the in between the DVD and the pandemic generation, there would have been comedy changed forever, right? Like the way that it was distributed and people did it had already changed, and then the pandemic came along on top of that and, you know, accelerated that change for people. Like, I love bad advice, whether it be about life or work, but often, yeah, work is a place where someone will offer you bad advice or advice that was good advice to them at the time, but unfortunately the world has changed and it's not good advice anymore. Do you remember any good or bad advice that you got along the way?
When it comes to comedy, two things always. First of all, kill your darlings. Always, 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 especially in a post-DVD, pre-pandemic world where, and now post-pandemic, the churn of material is so high, you cannot attach yourself to any one single joke you wrote. Who cares if someone else wrote it? Back yourself as a writer, write a million more. If you are precious about one specific joke you wrote, that means that you think your talent is finite. I'm very passionate about that. And I also think there's a rush.
I could tell. I was just letting it be because of your passion for it. I was like, yes.
And then there's a Russian saying, best is the enemy of good. Don't be a perfectionist. You get it done as opposed to get it perfect.
Okay. These are good. They were both good. Well done.
Thank you.
This is very necessary for me right now as I'm like, 10 days out from doing my show for the first time.
Get it done.
I'm just gonna get it done. All right. If you could wake up tomorrow and you just had a skill, any skill, you don't have to learn how to do it. You don't have to do your 10,000 hours to perfect it. You just wake up and you are able to do it. What would you just love to be able to do?
The worm.
Oh, yeah. The breakdancing move, the worm. Yeah. And what would you do with that capacity? Like once you had it, like this is, you now know how to do it. Like give me an insight into how often, if you're someone who can competently, and I'm going to say do the worm well.
Yeah.
How often are you busting out the worm in your life? Like does it get incorporated into the act? Like is there any, or is this like a social situation? Like when is special occasions only, like, you know, weddings and funerals? I don't know. Like what's, like give me an insight into if you're suddenly someone who can do the worm really well, how often and in what situations are you doing the worm?
Three top situations that came into my mind. First of all, every single wedding. Yeah. Second of all, in front of your friend's baby.
Oh, that's good. Yeah,
oh my God. A toddler would love you to do the worm. And third is in like a corporate setting where you're doing two truths and a lie. You say you can do the worm as one of the, or that you can't do the worm as the two truths and a lie. And then they think that you can't. And then you bust it out in a conference room and like a double tree.
Because you win the game.
Yeah.
But you also then prove it by doing the worm in celebration.
That's a win-win.
That's a double win. You've done very well there. That's well thought out. Congratulations. You are hired. These are the questions a company needed to ask you. If people want to find your comedy, Olga, they can do that on the internet. It is widely available in all the sort of places that people find comedy. But if you want to direct them to stuff, particularly, you know, Australian audiences who might be newer to your work than people in the UK, like there's people who listen to this all over the world, but the majority of the audience for it is in Australia, and I know you're touring Australia. So where can people find stuff that is pre-existing? Where can they find you when you're on tour? I will make sure I do a proper intro of all this stuff at the start of this episode as well, but this is just the one we do at the end as well. So tell me some of that information.
You can find all my tour dates in Australia at rockandrollga.com. You can watch my special Just Friends on YouTube, and I think you can listen to OK Computer, not the Radiohead album that I've never heard about, on BBC Sounds.
You should sue them. You should sue Radiohead. It'd be great if you just started pretending you'd never heard of Radiohead. No. The name of the show is not a play on that.
Like, Will, even if I joke about this, imagine my DMs with men trying to tell me about Radiohead.
I mean, the worst. Like, I mean, literally targeting the worst, well-meaning, well-actually men. Like, this is the worst demo. Like, the high-minded, intellectualized, I'm not one of those sort of people, but I do need to point out
to you. It's like walking to a bar and saying, I don't know what the offside rule is. Please can someone explain it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but it's a very high-minded, just the balls, though, of just like, I don't know, I grew up in Russia. I'd never heard of Radiohead. I don't know.
No.
That's why I was so passionate about independent
Radiohead, is that
comedy.
Two words?
Yeah. I mean, both Radiohead and Words were words before Radiohead called themselves Radiohead. So who's the thief here? Right? you just see old you, like, and suddenly you realize she's Tom York's also in the pool. She swims over, whispers in his ear.
She whispers in his ear, you're nothing. Yeah. I'll see you at my funeral. Tom.
Former lover, Tom York. Okay, two questions and then we're done.
Yeah.
On my desk, I used to have, as close as I would have to an inspirational, motivational thing. It said, what would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail? And basically, for me, that was just a reminder that, don't let whether it's going to be good or not get in the way of doing it, right? Like, just do it and like try to make it good. But that you can interpret it in whatever way you want to interpret it is what I'm getting to. So what would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail?
Okay, I'll say the worm, but a few months ago I was at Disneyland.
Yes.
Quite high on weed, brag, with my best friend and my boyfriend. And I decided while I was in this like state of highness to confess to them. And I looked at them and I said, I've never told this to anyone before. And this is really embarrassing for me to admit, but I genuinely think I'm an amazing dancer. Like, I think I move very beautifully. And there was an uncomfortable amount of silence until my boyfriend grabbed me by the shoulder and he said, that was very vulnerable. I don't think I am a very good dancer, turns out. But if I could, I would try and dance professionally.
I mean, the only thing that you can possibly do is secretly learn how to do the worm to spite them all. Like, and then you've got to take them back to Disneyland. Like, you've got to return 1 year to the exact same date to Disneyland and say, remember when, and then just get down bust on the ground and just bust it out. Hopefully, maybe some of the characters join in. It becomes a thing. Like maybe a flash mob, you know.
But just for me, there's nothing more powerful than someone who's really good at dancing. And I would quite to be that person.
I would love to be amazing at dancing, but I don't share your delusion in this. I am very much, my self-critical is turned right up when it comes to my capacity to dance. But I do enjoy the skill of it. It is. I am often a person who will find my, on the rare times I am on social media, I will find myself distracted by videos of people dancing. And what I have noticed is in Sydney, near the there's a big venue in town, big, beautiful. They redid basically the convention centre and they've turned it into a huge performance venue in there, and a lot of stand-ups or do big shows if they're a big touring act in there. But it's also during the afternoon, like the – I always feel like the oldest man in the world when I try to describe this. Nothing that I'm saying is – wrong, but it's just because it comes from an old white man in Australia that it feels like it. I'm always like, but there's a next generation of like Asian Australians who live in the inner city, and part of what they do for fun is go down to like these outdoor areas and like make TikTok videos and coordinated dancing and like, you know, do all these like routines that they've worked out with each other. And I love it. Like, I love it on a level of like, you know, when you just like find something in the city.
That's so cool.
Where
yeah.
you're like, because you can just, I mean, they're doing it in public. It's not like you're allowed to watch. I feel like there's a time limit to how long you're allowed to watch. Like, sometimes I'm like, I'll move around a bit. I shouldn't. Like,
you're allowed to watch, you know. Your Honor.
Oh. Yeah. Like, I feel like I'm in the good parameters still, but occasionally I do get a little mesmerized by someone trying to nail a routine.
It is mesmerizing. Beautiful dancing is mesmerizing. It's like watching a waterfall. It's wonderful.
Yeah, no. So I dig that. That's a good answer. Okay, final question, and then we're done. We're out of here. Thank you so much for doing this. This has been so much fun.
Thank you so,
I've
so much for having
it.
Me.
Loved it. It's Thank been you, great. Will. I look forward to your shows in Australia. People should come and find those shows and go and see you live. All right. So final question. I have a time machine. So we've basically kind of like done a version of this already with you from the future, but I have a time machine. This is the standard final question. I can take you to the past. I can take you to the future. It's one trip. All I ask is, and I think, you know, you're an experienced person, so I think this is going to be fine for you. But all I ask is that you use it purely for yourself. Like, you don't need to go back and, like, this technology in this hypothetical is now available for us. Unless your pet passion in your life has been to kill Hitler, you don't need to kill Hitler. I'm not going to rule it out if that's what you really want to do with your trip, but you don't need to do it. You don't need to solve climate change. You don't need to do whatever it is that, this is just a trip for you into the future or the past. Where would you just most like to go?
So my parents had their children at very different ages. So they had my sister when my mom was 21, my dad was 19. They had me in their 30s, my mom was 34. And then they had my brother when my mom was 44. So three different decades. And it always feels like we were raised by three different sets of parents because yes. they were in different stages of their lives. And so the sort of the parents that my brother had are not parents that I had, but both me and my brother are extremely jealous of my sister, who's older, and the parents that she got to have because she was raised by a teenager, right? And so she would like, my parents are now sober. She used to party with them. And I remember distinctly that at her on her 18th birthday, they took her to a nightclub and took shots with her. And every time I hear that story, a person who was raised by sober parents, all I want to do is get into that time machine and go party with my parents and my sister on her 18th birthday in that nightclub.
Yes. What a great answer. What a great story. And just what a fascinating chapter in this story of you. Like, I mean, again, they're fascinating. I wanted like a TV show about them. I want your spin-off about all your adventures that you've been having. I want to know more about Phil, but that's a story for another time. it's been so lovely to have you as part of this show. I really appreciate it. And thank you
so much, Will, for having me. I really, really, really appreciate it, and I had so much fun. Thank you.
Listener.